Carnegie Mellon, and even computer companies like Digital. For example, at one point I needed a PDP-11 cross-assembler that ran on the incompatible time-sharing system on the PDP-10. Well, I found one that ran on DEX time-sharing system, which they later called TOPS-10, and I used to call BOTS-10 because I felt that a praising name, a name that contained praise, was not appropriate for that system. So I got it, and it was free software. It had been written by somebody at Digital, apparently. And so I ported it to the incompatible time-sharing system, and I added a bunch more macro features, and we used it. And then somebody at BBNN wanted to run it on 10X. So he ported it and added more macro features, and then he got back in touch with me, and we merged it with conditionals so that we maintained a common source. And this seemed like the natural way for, you know, people developing knowledge to work together. In those days, of course, there wasn't a free software movement. It was just how we lived. And in fact, I believe free software goes back to the very dawn of computing. But through the 1970s, this started to change. First, computer companies like Digital started making proprietary software. There was a computer lab at Harvard where they had a policy of always making all of the system source code available for the users to read. They couldn't keep it on disk because the disk was too small, but at least they had a listing printed out so that, because they said, we're an educational institution, part where people come here to learn about computer systems. Well, part of what they should be able to learn about is how the operating system works. So they said that all the programs that were in the operating system, all the installed system programs, they insisted had to have a listing there. Well, at one point, somebody offered them, quote, free, unquote, a copy of a proprietary utility. And they said, no, we won't install it here. We refuse to install it because if we can't put a copy of the source code on display for people to study, then we shouldn't have it. And I was really impressed by somebody who cared more about doing the right thing than about what was convenient in a technical sense. You know, engineers tend to be constantly thinking about what's the most convenient, how can I get this done fastest, and in the process of doing that, they pay less and less attention to the question of what's right and wrong, what makes a good community. So they made a special example by not being like the rest. So, in the early 1980s, the free software community really fell apart because even people at universities stopped participating. For what really killed it was the Scribe text formatter, because the guy who wrote that, instead of sharing it with the community in the usual way, sold it to a company. Well, he now admits that the main result of that was to cause it not to be used very much. But at the time, I suppose he didn't know that. And, he was nice to us. He gave MIT a, quote, free, unquote, copy. That is, we didn't have to pay for it the way everyone else did, that we could run, but no source code. And then I remember one day somebody reported that it wouldn't handle his file, and one of the hackers started debugging it, which wasn't easy given the fact that it didn't have symbols, and eventually figured out what the problem was. It had a deliberate bug that would make it cease to work after a certain date. It took him hours to figure that out, and he was very mad. Well, the problem is that we had a community where people had voluntarily helped each other, and when people saw that one person was being uncooperative for money and getting rewarded for being an asshole, other people started to feel, well, I'd like some money too. Maybe I should be uncooperative. The society collapsed. Essentially, I lived through society turning into a jungle where nobody will help each other anymore. We did run on computers made by various different companies, computers with completely different instruction sets, and that was Unix. I had never used Unix, but I decided that this provided a good model to give us a reasonably good chance of producing a system that people could use. And what's more, by making the system compatible with Unix, it would mean that there was a large community of people who would be in a position to switch fairly easily. Whereas if I simply looked at all the various operating systems I had worked on and designed my idea of an ideal, clean, beautiful operating system, it would be incompatible, and maybe nobody would ever use it except a handful of hackers. So I decided to make the system compatible with Unix. And besides, Unix had some good ideas in it, things like pipes and redirection, and shell programming was nice. So the simplicity of the file system naming was nice. So there were also bad things about it, some of which we're stuck with for compatibility's sake, like the fact that when you start writing an existing file, it truncates the file instead of superseding it the way previous operating systems had done. You know, on good operating systems, you start to write a file named foo, there's already a file named foo. Well, your version of foo gets written and written and written, and eventually you say, okay, I'm finished, and then instantaneously the new copy replaces the old copy, and anybody reading foo at any time sees a valid version, either the old one or a new one. Well, I mean, you can do this with renaming, but it's somewhat kludgy. You've got to pick a name for it to have in the meantime. It's ugly. Anyway, and the directory has to give you write permission in order for you to do that, it's impossible. So it's somewhat of a mess, but it can't be fixed because of compatibility. Too many things would break if we tried to change that. Well, anyway, so Unix had good ideas and bad ideas, but overall it was good enough. So I decided we would make a Unix-compatible operating system, and then the next thing I needed was a name. Well, there is a hacker tradition that when you are writing something compatible with an existing thing, you can give it a name that is a recursive acronym which says, this thing is not the other. So, for example, there was the editor Tico, and there were many implementations of Tico, more or less compatible, and they were all called Tico, typically. But then somebody had the brilliant idea of calling it Tint, which stood for Tint is not Tico. And then there was Emacs, and there were many implementations of Emacs-like editors, and many of them were just called something or other Emacs, but one was called Fine, for Fine is not Emacs, and then there was Sign, for Sign is not Emacs. And then on the Lisp machine, there was Ina, for Ina is not Emacs. And then when Ina was almost completely rewritten, but not totally, the new version was called Zwei, for Zwei was Ina initially. So, of course, I needed a recursive acronym, and I looked around, and the word GNU is one of the funniest words in the English language because, you know, English has crazy spelling rules, but a silent G at the beginning of a word is weird even for English. And so people make lots of jokes and funny songs about that word. So once I realized I could use that word, GNU's not Unix, well, I couldn't possibly consider anything else. So I had a funny name. Every hacker needs to have a funny name for a program. And I had the overall design. It was possible to start working. So I wrote up a sort of design proposal, and I started sending it to companies, saying to them with this logic, you might expect you or your customers to be spending perhaps millions of dollars a year on Unix license costs. If you invest a tiny fraction of that in this project, then if we succeed, you can save that money. So even if you think there's only a small chance we will succeed, it's a worthwhile investment for insurance purposes. it's still a worthwhile bet. So I gave that to executives at some companies, and sometimes the executives thought it was an interesting idea, but there was never any follow-up. So I said, well, I guess there won't be funding. I'll just start coding. So that's what I did. I resigned my job at MIT, but I was surprised that the head of the lab suggested that I should keep my key and keep using their computers. So I didn't have to go find computers to use. And for the first few years, I was using an MIT computer. At the time, the first thing to do was look around and see what existing software there was, because putting together a free operating system doesn't mean you have to write every component from scratch. In fact, it's such a big job that you want to find as many existing free components as you can just to make the rest of the job feasible. So one thing I thought I might be able to find was a compiler. I'd heard of something called the Free University Compiler Kit, or VUC, because this comes from the Netherlands. So I contacted the author and said, I'm developing a free Unix-like operating system. We need a C compiler. Can you contribute this? And he sent me a rather nasty response. He said, the university is free, but the compiler isn't. Why don't you forget that silly idea? I'd like to have some utilities to distribute with the compiler to encourage more people to buy it. Why don't you supply me with some utilities, and I'll give you a share of the profits? Now, if he had just said no, I mean, if that's not too unusual, but I mean, for somebody to just try to enlist me in some disgusting scheme, I told him, the first thing I'm going to work on is a free compiler, thank you. So I got my hands on a compiler called Pastel, which had been written at Lawrence Livermore Lab as part of a supercomputer project, but it was a compiler that was designed to handle multiple languages and multiple machines. But the only language it handled so far was the Pastel language, which is Pascal extended in every way anyone could ever imagine. They said that the name Pastel meant off-color Pascal. So my first step was to implement a C front end, and I did. And then I decided to port it from the VAX to the 68000. So I wrote the code, and then I started trying to bootstrap the thing onto the 68000. And then I pretty quickly came to a problem I couldn't solve. Namely, the 68000 Unix system I had available would only give you 64K of stack, maximum. But this compiler expected to use megabytes of stack. And not only that, it had been written for a supercomputer project in which they figured, so what if we use 64 megabytes of memory for compiling everything? So the way it was written, it read your whole source file into code, parsing it into syntax trees, and then it converted each function into intermediate code, and then it output the whole thing as binary or a listing, and it never freed any storage in the whole process. So this was a pretty serious problem, and I wasn't sure what to do. So I put it aside, and I wrote GNU Emacs. And GNU Emacs was the first piece of GNU software that was actually useful. And it was the beginning of 1984 when I started the project. I started GNU Emacs in September, and the next year it was becoming useful. So I distributed it by anonymous FTP. But in addition, there were people not on the network who wanted to use it, who asked how could they get copies. So I decided that I would offer to mail them copies for $150. Now, at this point, a lot of people think that there's a contradiction, and they say to me, what do you mean it's free software if it costs $150? Well, the English word free has two meanings. One meaning refers to price, and one meaning refers to freedom. There's a word that specifically refers to zero price, and that's gratis. But there's no word that specifically and only refers to something that has freedom. So there's no better way I can say it. But free software is a matter of freedom, not price. So you should think of free speech, not free beer. So free software tends to mean that many people will redistribute it. So there's a pretty good chance you can get a copy at no charge or at very little charge But that's not what it's all about. The goal is not to save, to have this person pay less money to this person. I'm not on a crusade that programmers should not get money. I mean, I'm a programmer. I like having money. All else being equal, I would rather have more money. But that's not the only thing that's important. I won't get more money by undermining cooperation in society and putting chains onto other people. But if I can make money without doing that, then why shouldn't I? So it's not the selling of a copy for money that's the evil. The evil in ordinary proprietary software is something different. It's putting the chains onto you after you have a copy. That's what's wrong. And I found out, I realized how wrong this was when I had a particular experience. During the 1970s, we used some printers at the AI lab that had been given to us by Xerox. First, we used something we called the Xero graphic printer. It wasn't a laser printer. It was something more old-fashioned than that. It had a one-dimensional CRT in it. So it could print, you know, it printed a matrix of bits, sort of like a laser printer, but it was sort of wavy and not such good resolution. And it was very slow, and it got jams very often. And the software was free software. We had the source code, and we put in features to make the printer work well for us. For example, it took a long time to get to your printout. But we added a feature that when your printout was finished, it would display a message on your screen immediately saying your file such and such has been printed. So you wouldn't have to wait any extra time guessing when it was done. And when the paper jammed or it ran out of something, it would display a message on the screen of everybody who was waiting for a printout saying, the printer is broken, you better come fix it. Well, of course, these people would immediately head for the printer and fix it. They didn't want to have to wait. So the result was the printer would get fixed very quickly. Although it was unreliable, its duty cycle was almost 100%. I think I'm the person who added that last feature. I'm proud of it. It's working around the deficient hardware. Anyway, then Xerox gave us a laser printer. That was in the late 70s, the first time we'd ever seen a laser printer. It was this tall and this big. It was essentially a fast Xerox machine that had been fitted with the laser equipment. And it was driven by a special spooling computer, which ran non-free proprietary software. So when you would print a file, it would immediately tell you your file has been spooled. And then you'd have to guess how long to wait. So you'd maybe guess an hour. So you'd go back, or you'd guess, you just realize, I'm going to have to wait a while. So you go back to work. An hour later, you realize, hey, maybe it's long enough. I should go see if my printout is out. So you go there and you see the papers, it's been jammed for half an hour. So you fix it and go back to work. And maybe half an hour again, you realize, hey, I should go back to the printer. Maybe now it's come out. And you go back there, you see it printed 200 pages of other people's stuff and jammed again. So then you decide, I'm going to stay here and fix it over and over until my printout is out. Now, we were certainly competent to add the features that we needed. But Xerox wouldn't let us add it because they wouldn't give us the source code. We were prisoners of our software. So this illustrates one of the freedoms that the term free software means, the freedom to help yourself by changing the software to do what you need. Well, one day I heard that there was a person at Carnegie Mellon who had a copy of the source code. So the next time I was in Pittsburgh, I went to his office and said, hey, could I have a copy? Which was what we always did. But he said, no, I promised I wouldn't give you a copy. I was so stunned I didn't know what to say. I just walked out. But he didn't just do that to me. He did that to you, too. He promised not to give you a copy. He did that to you, too. He promised not to give you a copy. In fact, he had done that, I would expect, to everybody in this room, just about everybody in the entire world. He He had essentially betrayed the entire world to get something for himself. He had signed a non-disclosure agreement. This was my first experience with a non-disclosure agreement. I was the victim. And that was actually very good for me, to be the victim. So the first time someone asked me to sign one of those things, I said, no, it's unethical for me to sign this. If I sign this, I will be betraying other people. I will be promising not to help other people who I should be willing and able to help as a decent citizen of society. And this points out the second of the freedoms that free software refers to, and that is the freedom to help your neighbor. Because if you're forbidden to help your neighbor, there is no society. For computer users, the most fundamental way that you help your neighbor is by sharing information from your computer to your neighbor's computer. If we accept a system of society, whether it's imposed by law or whether it's so-called voluntary, but the cost of not participating is tremendous, so you can't. Either way, we have accepted an ugly way of life. The third level of freedom that the term free software refers to is the freedom to help build your community. The way you help build your community is by making improvements in a free program and then releasing an improved version that other people can then use and further add to. So these are the three freedoms that the term free software refers to. If something doesn't include these freedoms for everyone, then it is not free software. So, I was selling tapes for $150. But if you bought a tape, the software would come to you with all of these three freedoms, just as it would if you copied it from the net. So every user was free to cooperate and to improve things. Now, because I had seen the disintegration of the old software sharing community, I felt that the new one ought to have more of a defense against being abused. And I also was fully aware that there were people who would simply love to take a free program I wrote, make a proprietary modified version, and then distribute that as an executable that you can't understand with no source code, and say that people are forbidden to share it. And I realized that if they did this, I would be playing catch-up. I would be in the position of trying to redo the improvements they had made, or else many users who are concerned only with convenience and performance might switch to the proprietary version, and I would have failed to achieve what I was trying to achieve. So I wanted to make sure that there was a reason why, at least in some ways, if you participate in the community, you must contribute your efforts to the community. And this was the reason for developing a general public license. At first, I released Emacs with a specific Emacs general public license. Later on, though, gradually redesigning this, I turned it into something that was subroutinized so that it could be invoked from any program. See, of course, legal language is really a kind of computer program almost. It's a program in legal ball, we could call it. So the GNU general public license is a subroutine in legal ball designed so that you can easily call it from any program you release so that you not only give each user, each person who receives it directly from you, the three levels of freedom, but you in fact guarantee these freedoms to each person who gets a copy. No middleman can pass along the software, stripping away the freedom, so that subsequent users are using a non-free program. If you look around at other free software, such as X-Windows, you can see that this is actually very common if it is not prohibited. if nothing is done to guarantee that every user must receive these freedoms, people will make proprietary versions. And often, in the case of X Windows, you can see that most users get the proprietary versions. There are all these, so many companies that do, or did at least, distribute Unix systems with proprietary versions of X Windows, and in many cases, the free version wouldn't even run on that computer, so there were people who couldn't use a free X Windows. All they got was a proprietary program with no more freedom than any other proprietary program. The general public license is what makes sure that can't happen to GNU software. Now, I should point out that there are several different categories of software based on their distribution terms. There's free software, there's GPL-covered software. A program can't, X Windows, for example, it's not GPL-covered, but it is, if we get the free version, at least that is free software. So we can use it in a free operating system, and we do use it in GNU systems. It's somewhat of a shame that it is not copylefted, but fundamentally, at least, it is a contribution to the free software community, and that's the most important thing. I'd like a cup of tea if somebody could convince them to bring, maybe 5 cups of tea, because I'll drink them one after the other. Well, on a tray, maybe somebody from the hotel could bring. I tried. I took some cough medicine just before coming down here, but what? I will keep going as long as I am capable. Well, and as long as they will let me, of course. You know, you might get bored after a while. The other thing that I found GPL does is that when people who work for a company, maybe it's a software company, make an improvement in a GNU program, the first thing the guy's boss is going to think is, hey, maybe we can hoard this, and maybe we can make our own improved proprietary version. Ah. But then, of course, the programmer himself wants to contribute the change. So the GPL gives the programmer an excuse to say, sorry, boss, but we're not actually allowed to do that. Here are the distribution terms, and they say that it would be copyright infringement if we did that. And the boss says, oh, well. Well, okay, you can contribute it. I'll sign off on it. And this happens from time to time. And as a result, we get to use the contributions of programmers who work for companies that make proprietary software. In some cases, companies actually fund the development of extensions, sometimes very important extensions. For example, the C++ compiler and the Objective-C compiler front ends were developed by organizations that normally make proprietary software. And in the case of the Objective-C front end, I had a meeting with Steve Jobs where he said to me, well, what would you think if we distributed the Objective-C files as .o files and said to the user, thank you, could you just put it down, or it'll fall off on that. So on the floor is fine. Thank you.
It's free.
Oh. But free in the sense of freedom or free in the sense of price? Are we free to copy this tea? Does anyone here have a tea copier? See, this is something people say to me, people who are thinking in a very simplistic way. They say to me, well, if software should be free, why shouldn't gasoline or tea be free? And I say, well, you know, someday when there's a gasoline copier or a tea copier or a car copier or whatever, then that will become a significant social question. But at the moment, since those things don't exist, the question doesn't really arise. What it means is that when people talk about intellectual property, they're talking about something which is very different from physical object property. But then because they use the same word property to describe them both, then they try to tell you that you should treat them as if they were the same. And that leads to intellectual error. So always be on guard against that. What is this? Oh, well, I guess not too bad. Better than coughing. Yeah, the transporter is malfunctioning today. Good thing I didn't go through it. Anyway, so then the word copyleft was suggested by a friend who... Uh-oh. I hope this wasn't demagnetizing my credit cards. Well, yeah, I guess it might be. I'll have to find out later. Anyway, I don't have any in here. So, so he wrote me a letter where the envelope was covered by all sorts of weird things, and one of them was copyleft, all rights reversed. And then I thought about it and decided I'd prefer copyleft, all wrongs reversed. Because I'm a person who very much thinks about justice and injustice. So I realized that copyleft could describe this practice. But the copyleft is a general idea. It's the idea of guaranteeing everyone certain freedoms by legally forbidding anyone to take them away from anybody else. The GNU GPL is one specific implementation of copyleft, and there can be others. In fact, the GNU Library Public License is a different implementation of copyleft. So, over the years, we filled in the gaps in the GNU system. By the early 1990s, the only major component that we hadn't either written or found was the kernel. We were working on a kernel, which was actually delayed by the fact that we had decided to base it on the Mach microkernel. But for a while, there was export control on the Mach microkernel. So now the GNU project was meant to be for the whole world, not just for the US. So we couldn't use anything that had an export control on it. So we had to wait for that to be lifted. We had been told it would be, and it was. And at that point, we could make a real decision to use it and start developing things based on it. But a little while after that, another kernel was released, and that was Linux. So by fitting Linux into the gap in the GNU system, people created a Linux-based GNU system. And this is the kind of GNU system that probably many of you use, and which is widely used today. It's also the kind that that I use, and it's used on many of the Free Software Foundation's computers. So where do we go from here? Well, of course, we don't have all the operating system facilities that we would want to have. Over the years, people have got used to having certain additional capabilities in operating systems, and anything that the users find important, free software needs to provide. Also, another thing that's happened during the past 14 years is that Microsoft Windows has become very popular. So we need to have good emulation for Microsoft Windows. Otherwise, people find themselves in the position of trying to encourage the developers of proprietary applications to make special releases, special versions of these applications for these Linux-based GNU systems. The problem there is that once you get involved in that particular way with these proprietary application developers, and if you start citing to users the existence of these proprietary applications for their Linux-based GNU systems, the problem is that, in effect, you're saying that these proprietary applications are a good thing. And this doesn't fit in with the message that to be part of a good society, you should be using only free software. It says, in effect, the opposite. Whereas if you provide people with an emulator for Windows, then they can run these applications if they want to, but you're not in the position of making it sound like those applications are a good thing. See, so the emulation solution is a good solution to the practical issue that people want to run those applications and they may feel that they can't use the free operating systems if they can't run the applications. It solves that problem even better while not putting you in a position of giving a mixed message. So emulation is a very important thing for people to help with. Of course, emulation is the way that we should try to support the millions or at least thousands of different applications that people want to use. But for the most important applications, we shouldn't try to deal with that through emulation. We need to provide free software implementations to do those jobs. So if you can think of some important kind of software application, if there isn't a free one already, we need one. The GIMP is an example of, you know, the kind of free application that we need to see addressed. We need to see them for all of the important kinds of application jobs. Another thing we need to do, another area where we need to do more is documentation. Because documentation is an essential part of software. And if the software is to be free, the documentation has to be free too. You have to be able to redistribute the documentation when you redistribute the software. And since you're free to change the software, you should be free to finish the job by updating the manual to describe your changes. You know, we shouldn't be in a situation where we're forced to do a bad job or forced to do only half the job. So free software needs free documentation, and it should be good documentation. But unfortunately, there are two reasons why we don't have all the free documentation we need. One of them is that hackers are more inspired to write programs than write documentation. It's just a fact of life. The skill of writing documentation is different from the skill of writing software. Hackers who can write good software may not be able to write good documentation. They may not have learned what it means or how to do that. You can learn, but it requires learning certain things, and it requires a lot of practice, too. The other problem, though, is not a lack, but it's the presence of something that actually interferes. And that is, there are proprietary books being published to document free software. And the problem is that many people think that fills the need. Many people don't realize that the existence of a proprietary book really doesn't do the job. So in this sense, therefore, the existence of O'Reilly manuals is actually setting us back. You see, if they simply existed but nobody paid attention, they wouldn't do any harm. You know, somebody writes an O'Reilly book about, say, Perl or some other important free program. Well, we're no worse off than we were. We still need to write a good free manual, but, well, that would have been true anyway. But the problem is that if so many people get the O'Reilly book and they think the job of documenting that program is done, then they won't do it. And so this is a serious problem. We need to inform other people that these non-free books, which can't be included in our free systems, fail to do the job, should not be thought of as supplying what the community needs. A further problem that I just learned about in a very thorough, personal way is the systems that mix free and proprietary software. Last weekend, as I was getting ready to go on this trip, the disk on my laptop died. Well, that made me very worried, especially when I couldn't buy a replacement the following day, which was Sunday. And then I had to leave with a non-working laptop. And my mail comes in so much, you know, 100 or more messages every day. If I don't do work every day, I get behind, and then it's horrible. So that may be why I'm sick. You know, it probably made it harder for me to sleep. Well, we ordered a disc. We had it sent by FedEx. On Thursday, we decided it was time to reinstall Debian, except the rescue disc wouldn't even start up. It's because this is a Toshiba. It's apparently a well-known problem. You need a different kernel version to run on this Toshiba. Well, what could we do? We didn't know that. I didn't find that out until yesterday. What we did was we installed SUSE instead. And what I discovered, I started seeing that worked. And when I started looking through their categories of packages to install, I saw some programs that I knew were not free software. They were all jumbled together with the ones that were free software. It didn't say even, you know, I said, well, show me the extended description. And it didn't say this package is not free software. They seem to be doing their best to bury that difference. And so the manual was in German, but my friend who was helping to install this stuff was German, so he looked there. It didn't have that either. The manual has a copy of the GPL in it, but there's nothing in there to help people realize what it applies to and what it doesn't. So it is absolutely impossible for people installing or using SUSE to really understand when they have freedom and when they don't. Essentially, SUSE is designed to confuse people about this. So here we attained finally this goal I had set of having free operating systems so that it was possible to use a computer with solely free software, possible to reject entirely the chains and the prohibition on sharing, the prohibition on cooperation. And now we're drifting back from there. So this is a real danger because historically we can see that in order to hold on to freedom, you must make an effort, and therefore you must value it. And in order to value freedom, you have to understand what it means to have or not have freedom. People who use SUSE, they're not going to understand when they have freedom or even really what it would mean, so they can't learn to value it, and they will not try to defend it. The world is full of situations where you could trade your freedom for some kind of immediate convenience. And business, of course, is very good at creating these situations and offering them to you. If you are not conscious of the need for freedom, if you haven't learned to value your freedom, you'll accept these opportunities because why wouldn't you? It's convenient. If you don't realize that you're losing anything, you won't see a reason to say no. So we have to do a better job of informing people what these freedoms are, informing people when they have these freedoms and when they don't, and encouraging people to value freedom. Well, it is, I think, about the time that I was supposed to have to stop. I don't know if they were... I promised... I know. Well, they said there was going to be rearrangement of the room and setting up. And I spoke with Marvin about the possibility that they could do that on the side while I continue to speak. And I haven't heard from him yet whether I can. I guess I might as well start talking about the herd, because I promised I would talk about the herd, so I'll do that now. Unfortunately, I don't have anything I can write on. I don't think they want me to write on this. So I won't. Oh, I see, over there. This stuff seems to be actually pretty good at getting my throat clear.
The cooking's getting better.
I was just told you can do as long as you wish.
Oh, good, I can continue. Until you get bored. Watch your feet, though. Thank you. It's not the whole GNU kernel, but it's one big part of it. It's not the whole GNU kernel because it runs on top of Mach. Mach is a microkernel that was developed at Carnegie Mellon. We call it a microkernel because it doesn't do all of the jobs that we would normally expect a kernel to do. For example, it does not contain a file system. It does not contain any support for network protocols. Its support for a terminal is limited to output a character and read a character. So if you want characters like Control C and Delete and Control U to do something special, that has to be done, implemented at a higher level. So the facilities of Mach include multiple address spaces. You can create processes. Each process is an address space. And each process can have a set of capabilities. The address space is made up of memory objects, which you can map into the address space. Within each process, there are multiple threads of control that can... Each thread has a stack and a set of registers and a program counter. They share all the rest of the process. Then Mach takes care of scheduling among these threads, and it also implements message passing. I mentioned that a process can have capabilities. A capability is really just a way of, just something you can send messages to. And typically it goes to a port that belongs to another process, so the other process can receive the messages. And everything else is implemented on top of that. However, there are also some built-in message handlers to give you access to the hardware facilities of the machine. For example, if the machine has a serial line, there's something you can send a message to which will output a character. And there's something that you can send a message to and it will give you the next character. If the machine has an Ethernet interface, there's something you can send a message to send a packet. And there's something you can send, and you can also send it a message to receive a packet. But that's anything other beyond that you have to implement above the level of Mach. With a disk, there will be a built-in disk driver which you can use to read and write disk blocks. So, there are various ways of making a whole kernel. The old-fashioned way is it's one big program. It implements various system calls which go through a basically trivial C library containing just stubs. This is the method used for the Unix kernel, and this is also how Linux works, and it rests on the bare machine. This is the monolithic kernel. Well, when people started using Mach, their first way of doing so was to chop the bottom off a monolithic kernel and port it to run on top of Mach instead. That's the so-called single-server approach. So you have Mach running here, and then on top of this, you have a program which implements the same system calls with the same libc, and this you might call Unix with the bottom removed. This is the single server method. And I believe this is how all the existing systems that use Mach actually work. And various different systems have been made to work in this way, various different kernels, including Linux. And also others such as the MS-DOG kernel and various versions of Unix and maybe other things. Anyway, the Open Software Foundation, which is now called the Open Group, is working on something they call the multi-server. And it works like this. There are these various programs that send messages to each other. And these communicate with a system called Trapper, which sends messages to some of them. And it implements the same system calls through the same trivial libc. And they all, and all these servers then run on top of Mach. Well, this provides some advantages of modularity, and the operator can replace individual servers or even set up an entirely separate set of servers, which is good for debugging the next version of the servers. However, as far as an ordinary user is concerned, the facilities available are the facilities of Unix. The user can't replace these individual servers. The user can't really tell that they are servers. It's just sort of all hidden. So the user doesn't really get any benefit. The approach used in the herd is somewhat like this, but somewhat different. Well, I guess it might fit here. What we have is various servers, and then there is a more complicated libc, which offers the same system calls as subroutines, but instead of being trivial stubs that just do a trap, they do real work. And they send messages to particular servers as needed. And the servers can also send messages to each other. So instead of having the servers hidden from the user through the system call trapper, the servers are simply capabilities that this user process has. And the user program can send messages to them explicitly if you want to. So you can either use the Unix facilities, which will send messages as needed, and you don't have to know when that is, or you can use the extended facilities, the Mach facilities, which will just send a message to anywhere. And if you want, you can send a message to something else, or you can send a message to one of these servers, and as you wish. And of course, there's Mach down here, as in the other three. So you might say this is the hacker's way of doing it. Make all the facilities that are there available directly to the user as much as possible. So what are these servers? Well, most of them are actually file or device servers. For example, each of the devices in /dev is implemented by a particular program. For example, /dev null is implemented by a pretty simple program, a program which, by the way, any user could write and install. You don't need special privileges because you see, that particular, the job that the null device does doesn't require privileges to carry it out. The only reason why a device would need any privilege is if it wants to, say, use a raw I/O device, which you need privilege to do. For example, the main disk file system, that's a program that I suppose is connected to some of these files in /dev, but it's a set UID program because it needs to be able to access the actual disk, which is something that is a privileged operation that normally only root or whatever could do. So, however, you could run the disk file system program using some ordinary file as instead of a disk. And to do that, you don't need any privileges. You just have to create a file where you want it to keep its disk blocks, and then, you know, you create that in your directory where you can create it, and then you can run the disk file system, and it will use your file as a disk. And so pipes, for example, are also implemented using a particular program as the file server. Essentially, the feature that we've added to the ordinary disk file system, we're using a highly modified version of ext2, but although we also have a port of the BSD file system, which does the same kinds of things, we've added the feature that each inode can have a translator attached to it, the translator being the program you should run to implement this file. In effect, it's an abstract object type of file system where each name can have attached to it a program to implement the behavior. Of course, there are plenty of ordinary files, too. Well, this creates quite a bit of power. And the fact that any ordinary non-privileged user can set up translators gives it even more power. So what can you do with these translators? Well, for example, we now have an FTP fission from the kernel. And any other kind of file access protocol that you might have, you could implement a directory which does it automatically in the same fashion. Write a new version, it just checks that in or something. You know, whether this would actually work well in practice, I don't know. Hasn't been done yet. Another thing you can do is a generalized version of a symbolic link. Symbolic links, I'm not sure whether symbolic links are implemented with a special translator. I think that for efficiency, they're probably implemented in the standard file system directly. But it's easy to write a translator that behaves like a symbolic link, and then you could generalize it. For example, imagine a symbolic link with a sequence of different targets so that you just try them in order until you find one that works. Well, imagine if the targets are directories. This then gives you something a lot like a search path. You know, I have this file foo, which is a link to the sequence A, B, C, and D. Well, then I try to open foo/bar. What will it do? It'll try A/bar, B/bar, C/bar, and D/bar. Of course, if you really want, of course, we can't really implement it in that simple a fashion if we want really good results, because we want to be able to list this directory too. And listing the directory foo, to do that, of course, you have to list all those different directories and combine them. So it needs to be somewhat more complicated than that. But the result is you can produce a sort of virtual union directory. And we've decided that's what we're going to do for /bin. So no more having these various different binary directories which you have to look around in to see where a program really is sometimes. Of course, you know, if your path is set up right and you want to run it, you don't have to care which directory it's in. But sometimes you do have to care. And then it's somewhat of a nuisance. Well, the way we're going to do it, we can still have those different directories. If you want to subdivide them, like to put them onto different file systems, you can. But then they all magically show up in /bin so that you don't, for most purposes, have to know which one it's in. But we can take that even further. We've designed a very neat package management system that is not implemented yet, but I hope will be reasonably soon, based on these virtual union directories. The idea is that there are several directories. One of them is /bin, but maybe /user/lib is another. Several directories where packages typically want to install their files. And typically, package management systems work by, there's an install command, and it actually copies or moves files into these directories. and the deinstall command deletes them from these directories. Well, instead, we're going to virtually make them appear in those directories. And here's how it works. We have a directory called /packages, which contains symbolic links to the places where packages have been unpacked. So you unpack a package, maybe into a place like this, like disk1/foo/emacs20.2, say. You just happen to unpack this into /disk1/foo. Could be anywhere where you find disk space. So you make a symlink, which say you call it emacs, from /packages to there. Well, the instant this symlink exists, automatically certain files in here start to be visible in these directories. And the way it works is this has various directories, like subdirectories, like bin and user lib. And what happens is when the symbolic link is here, the program that implements /bin, it sees the symlink and says, all right, I'll look for a bin subdirectory under there. And the same program, of course, will be implementing user lib. So it will see the symlink and say, all right, I'll look for user lib under here. And the same for all the other directories you're going to, like, you know, like maybe like etsy init.d, if the package is a daemon that needs to be started up automatically. Well, it would have an init.d subdirectory, and so inside of that would be the script to start and stop it. So that would automatically appear there too, and I guess it might typically have an rc.2 and so on, and whatever else it needs. So that basically automatically everything appears in the right place. Nothing actually needs to be copied or moved or renamed. And if I want to deinstall, I just delete the symlink, and they're automatically instantly gone. Meanwhile, if you want to find all the files that are part of a certain package, they're all in one place. So, ah, well, there's a feature for that too. Because suppose you want to install Emacs 20.2, but you want to install it experimentally. After all, Emacs 20 is very new, and there's still a number of things that haven't been shaken out yet. So suppose you want to make Emacs 20 available, but you want the Emacs command to still run Emacs 19.34. So you've got a symlink, say, that Emacs points to something or other /Emacs 19.34. So what are you going to do here? Well, the feature is you call the symlink this. The programs that implement these directories, basically, when they see a colon in the symbolic link name, that means for user visible binaries, namely for /bin, you should append this name. So that the file /bin/emacs in this will appear as emacs-20.2 over here, because it'll have this -20.2 added to it. Of course, this could be any string you want to add to it. You could call it emacs-new or whatever. Well, then you get a name conflict, and I suppose one of the names would be visible and the other wouldn't. I mean, you know, you know, if somebody asks for something self-contradictory, whatever happens isn't exactly wrong, and there's nothing you can do that would be exactly perfectly right, so don't worry about it too much. You know, if he installs two symbolic links that both give you the same file appearing in bin, then bin will give you one of them. And when you list the directory, you'll see two of them.
What if you have different packages which have entries in a single file, like etc. mime types or something?
For that, You could do it by implementing that file, et cetera, MIME types, with a special translator that knows how to concatenate the contents of a certain directory so that installing a package would cause a new file to appear in that directory. And then when you read this file MIME types, you will automatically get the concatenation of them. So once again, installation doesn't need to edit a file. Well, actually, it won't have to look through all of these every time you look in slash bin, you see, because it can cache the information. And there's a feature in the file system that you can ask the file system to send you a message if there's a change in a certain particular inode. So the slash bin program will make that request for slash packages and for each of these symlinks and for whatever directories in here it had to look in to compute the results. So then it just contains a table saying exactly what's in slash bin and where it's really supposed to be found. And that means it can look up just as fast as any directory. But if there's a change, if you either change a symlink or if you change the contents of one of these packages too, the program will get a message, it will recompute its table, and the exactly right things will happen. I don't know anything about Plan 9, so I don't know if you might be right.
Well, it doesn't matter. Anyway, the problem I can see here is, what about dependencies?
What about what?
Dependencies.
Dependencies between packages. Well, what does a dependency between packages mean? It means that a certain package won't run. I have to stop? Really? Oh, well, that's just, they said I can continue as long as I wanted to.
We moved to another room.
Yeah, basically, well, I'll probably finish up about the herd, and after that I'll just play some music. But anyway, so you install A, and A won't run without B. So you try to run A, it will give you an error. So there's still room for some kind of package system to keep track of these dependencies and inform you. You know, if you want to install A, you probably should install B too. Okay, so it can just still do that. Yeah, I mean, we could conceivably have something where, you know, there'd be another thing in here like dependencies. And the thing in slash bin, when you try to invoke the package, if there's a thing in depths, it would look at that first, and it would check the dependencies. And if the dependencies weren't there, then instead of running this program, it would instead run something saying, this package depends on certain other packages, and they're not here. See, as much as you want to program in terms of user-friendliness, I guess, is possible. The point is that it's abstract object file system, so any behavior you think is better, you can program as an ordinary user on top of the standard facilities. A couple of other things you can do. You can also replace your own terminal driver. Because, you see, each user will have his own terminal driver process. And part of our philosophy is we let ordinary users change as much as possible. So since the terminal driver you're using is only for you, we just let you say, all right, let me run this other program as my terminal driver. So, for example, maybe you could hook up Emacs to be your terminal driver.
What about security?
Well, I personally think my term for security is fascism, in which basically I'm following the old tradition of hackers. You see, it's a sad thing about a computer. I have nothing against privacy. It's not terribly important to me, but I think people should be able to have privacy. Especially from the government. But there's a problem in a shared computer system. There's only one way to give each user privacy, and that is basically to chain every user all the time. Imagine if you had a wall for looking at photos, and you wanted to have a bunch of people sitting, looking, each one looking at his own photos on that wall, How do you stop people from looking at other people's photos? Well, basically, you lock the person's head in position so that he can't turn his head and look at the others. That's the way privacy and security work in a shared computer. And so basically, I call it fascism. I feel that's not the way I want to live. I am about to be an exile from the internet. I'm not going to be on the internet anymore in about a week or so. Basically, MIT doesn't want to connect us to the internet anymore, and the other ways we can do it will require us to have security on our machines. Well, I've said that the other FSF staff can have computers with security just as long as I don't ever have to use those machines. I won't use them. So I'm going to have to get my mail and send my mail over phone lines and not really be on the internet, because the internet has become a place where they won't anyone who doesn't have security is now considered some kind of troublemaker, and it's not accepted. But as usual, if the whole world has changed, I'm not willing to change with it if I think the change is bad. So I'm just going to have to part company with the internet. I've been using the internet since before it was the internet. Since the ARPANET first was developed in the early 70s, I've been using it, and now I won't be anymore. But I'll still be able to read your bug reports. So I will still be doing my work. However, I probably won't have any access to the web, so when people send me URLs to look at, I'll have to send me back, could you please mail me the contents of that? Anyway, but the GNU system, however, of course, if you look around, you'll see that GNU programs don't refuse to support security features, because it was clear to me even at the beginning that if I insisted on making GNU a system with no security, that most people wouldn't use it. And that would make it fail to give people freedom to share software. So the herd actually has some fairly interesting security features. For example, the Unix way of becoming root is you start a new shell, which is root. It has a different UID. But in the herd, access powers are represented by a capability that goes to a special server called the authorization server. And so if you run, we have a thing that's the equivalent of SU called add authorization. So if you supply the root password to add authorization, it will add root access to your existing authorization capability, and as a result, your Emacs becomes root. You don't have to have one Emacs to be you and a different Emacs inside of your SU to do root things. You can just basically enable your privileges by running add authorization. All of your existing jobs become root. And then when you're finished doing whatever it was you wanted to be root for, you can then turn off that authorization and go back to being just yourself, and now the same existing Emacs is not root. Of course, you can use this in much more flexible ways, too. You can make multiple different authorization capabilities, and then you can change one while not changing the others. And so whether all that much flexibility is going to be useful or for what, I don't know. But the ability to make your existing Emacs into a root Emacs is definitely going to be very convenient.
But under what capabilities do the system binaries then have? Under which user they run?
Well, that's basically the same as it is on Unix or with a Linux-based GNU system. It's, you know, a program can be set UID or not. So, and it has a certain owner. So if it's a set UID program, it'll get the access of that owner when it runs, and otherwise it just inherits your access.
Richard, sorry to interrupt you. Okay, ich habe eine gute Idee. Ihr könnt euch mit Richard jetzt alle in den grünen Salon verfügen. Da könnt ihr gerne noch bis Mitternacht weiter diskutieren. Thank you very much.
Thank you and good riddance.
Mal noch eine kurze Anmerkung. Wir müssen jetzt gerade vorne hier. Für diejenigen, die also dann vielleicht